Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Bill Nowlin, the author of Vinyl Ventures, My 50 Years at Rauner Records. Bill, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
So can you talk a little bit about why you decided to write this book?
Well, I started it in 2008, actually, and then kind of put it on the shelf for a while. I was aware that Rauner, having begun in the year 1970, was approaching our 50th anniversary. And I just wanted to memorialize things while we still had access to all our records, all our file cabinets and information and details and so forth. I just wanted to start telling a story and putting it together. And there are a couple times that it looked as though another company might put out another press might put out a book on Rauner. So I shelved it a couple times, but as we were approaching the 50th anniversary and a third possibility fell through, I decided, well, time to see if maybe I should put this out right at the time of the 50th anniversary.
I'm hoping you can start out by talking a little bit about how Rauner founded, how you founded Rauner, how it got started.
We were three college students at the time. Actually, I think we'd all graduated college when the company started, but we followed a lot of folk music in the middle 1960s there and often went out a couple nights a week to see different bands come through town. We liked to buy records of groups that we liked, but there were groups that didn't have records out or hadn't had a record out for many years. And we started writing to some companies, asking them about putting out a record of this band of ours and another group that we liked. And a couple of them wrote back and said, well, if you send us a tape, we'll consider it. So we thought, okay. But in the end, when we first came up with a tape and that we acquired a tape that had already been made and wasn't being used for $100, and then we made our first album for a total cost of $7, and we just decided to do it ourselves. I mean, I'd run a humor magazine in college, done a couple of issues of that, and had a little bit of experience doing what we call publishing, maybe. But we really didn't know anything about business. I often tell the story about dropping off our first records at a local store. And they said, well, be sure to send us an invoice. And I had no idea what that word meant. This was a different era, maybe. And in the 60s, we were all kind of hippies and not interested in business at all. Just didn't know the basics. But apparently over the years, we developed rather quickly the instinct. I mean, it's kind of logical sense. If you buy something and then sell it for more than you paid for it, you have built up a little bit of money that you can put towards the next project. We didn't draw any salaries for 4 years. We didn't pay any taxes for 4 years. We didn't do anything other than put everything we had into making these records because it was fun. And we got a lot of positive feedback from a lot of other people that said, what are you going to do next? You know, here's an idea. How about recording this band? And let me, one guy, Doug Parker, offered to design our first album cover for free if we let him design all the rest of them for free. And he was just trying to build a resume. And we did, you know, I don't know, maybe did 7 or 8 albums. And eventually we decided, you know, to pay him or use other people and things. So it just kind of grew. I call it a hobby that got out of control, because none of us ever intended to go into business. We all expected to be teachers or otherwise involved in our different pursuits. And this is just something that happened over time.
Right. And you talk about like sort of falling into some of this throughout the book, like that you were going to be a collective, and even I love the story of how you finally hired a lawyer to help you. And it was like, you know, he was asking for things that you had, but you didn't know the names of it. Right.
The first accountant that we talked about asked to see our accounts receivable journal. And I said, what's that? And he said, it's a list of all the people that owe you money. And I said, oh, we've certainly got that.
And also, I'm also spent a lot of time traveling around trying to collect music, which is sort of has a history in folk and a history in blues of that, like trying to preserve and collect. So can you talk a little bit about that too, especially at the beginning, what you were trying to do and preserve?
Sure. We lived in the Boston area. Ken and myself were roommates at Tufts University in the Boston area, and Marion, our third partner, she was a graduate student at Northeastern University. She later went to Clark. I went to the University of Chicago. Ken went to Cornell, but we basically were all based in the Boston area. And much of the music we liked was from the Southeast, was bluegrass and old time country music. A lot of the folk performers came from the southern part of the country. So we just started traveling to try to go see some of these people perform. We went to a number of bluegrass festivals down south. We visited the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., because we came to learn that they had a big folk music archive. And so we went in there to learn about what they had. And as I said, we had a lot of people that gave us pointers. You know, you should go here and check out this band and go there. And the three of us lived for the first two or three summers. We lived out of a Volkswagen van that I owned. It was Ken and Marion slept on the floor and I slept on the back seat. We had some curtains that we rigged up so we could sort of pull the shades closed. But we slept at nighttime and lived during the daytime and drove place to place, just making our way around. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, and a lot of your, at first you were a lot of selling your records was basically right out of that van going to shows. And so can you talk a little bit about that, that folk music scene that you were sort of really involved in and part of?
We put out our first two records in October 1970. And I mentioned dropping off some at a local store, but for the most part, stores asked us, who's your distributor? And we said, well, we don't have it. They said, well, we have to buy from a distributor. We can't just be buying from all these little companies that have one or two records. So we found a distributor locally and we started working with them. As we were traveling to some of these festivals, we set up a shop out in front. We just basically put out a couple sawhorses borrowed. We didn't carry our own sawhorses even, but we borrowed them at the local festival and just put up a little couple of boards and boxes of records. And we carried the records of 9 or 10 other small labels. So we had not just our two records, or the second year we put out three more, but we had a good selection of, you know, a couple hundred different titles that we carried. And people asked us, where can you get these? These are great records. I've never seen this one before. If we're not here, where can we get them? And so we started a mail order company. And that's one of the ways we really began to get our records around. People would send in orders and we were on the road, but a friend named Mark Wilson, who was a Harvard philosophy student back in Cambridge, he would collect the mail for us and then tell us, I'd be calling from North Carolina or something. He'd say, well, you got an order for these two albums from this person here. And I'd write down the address and we go to the post office and mail them the two records, essentially out of the back of our VW. And it's the business just built from there. It's kind of humorous looking back on it. It was fun at the time. And it's kind of even more fun in a way to believe that we actually made this work. And it grew because people wanted this music. We filled kind of a void at the time. And a number of other companies came along very shortly afterwards, but we were in the right place at the right time. And I guess, as I said, I guess we kind of had a good instinct for what would work. We never picked records because we thought we'd make a lot of money on them. We did them because we liked the music, but our tastes were reflected enough with a small community, I think, of other people that we were able to grow and grow at a reasonable pace. If we'd had some big hit early on, we would have been sunk because we didn't have any money. We had basically $1,000 was our startup capital, if you want to call it that. I never would have known what that meant at the time. But and we never, that's what we built on. We just sold enough. We made a little more money, put out some more records. We were working other jobs. I did start teaching college. I taught at university, taught political science. And at the time that brought in $9,000 a year, which was a pretty good pay back then, more than I needed. So we, you know, Marion worked as a secretary at a Greek theological seminary, and we pooled whatever money we had. You mentioned collective. We all did live in the same apartment, and we just shared everything. Any money that we had, we just shared it and put it all into this. This is what we did day and night, outside whatever responsibilities we might have had through work.
Yeah, and you... I love, you know, you talk about the mail order and sending these out. And I love that throughout you have little stories about experiences with certain, there's the one about the woman who ordered her Songs of Robert Burns. Yeah. Throughout, but we sort of get to see the feel of what it was like to sort of just be a part of this at the beginning. And you also talk about, like you said, you didn't have a big hit right away, but that you had no sense of when you should be creating these records, when you should be releasing records and all of that.
Right. We hadn't realized that there was, I mean, we didn't think about Christmas selling season, for instance, or something, that you shouldn't put out a record in December because, you know, stores don't really want to take in new products then. They want to sell the stuff that they've already stocked up on. We just put out stuff when it was ready. We also didn't know about marketing. And I would say it was maybe 3 or 4 years into the company where somebody asked us, you know, told us, listen, I'm trying to make my living playing music here. And you guys aren't really, you just put our records out, but you don't really try to sell them. And so we realized, partly because, and I mentioned another couple of companies came along soon after we did, we started losing a couple of acts that would move to another company that was a little more promotional oriented. So Marion in particular got involved with promotion and started making contacts with records, radio stations and some publications and so forth. And we started trying to sell the records.
Yeah, it seemed like eventually the three of you realized that you had different areas of expertise or different interests and that you were able and that it worked really well. It melded well together.
Yeah, I mentioned Marion was kind of more involved with promotion and publicity. Ken enjoyed working in the studio more with the musicians themselves. So he became much more active in that way. And I think partly just by nature and also the fact that I did have this college professor job that kept me busy during the day, at least 3 days a week, I gravitated towards more what you might call back office things like the books. Is accounts receivables journal that I didn't know what it meant. Paying the bills, making sure we paid the artist royalties because we wanted to make sure we were absolutely spick and span in terms of accounting to the artists and that kind of relationships with eventually the distributors. We all had them, but that became more my area of expertise, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And so you sort of made your way through the early 70s. And then you ended up going to a show and seeing a guy named George Thorogood in The Destroyer.
Yeah, that was the first big hit. And we were very fortunate with the way that record built because we did make a gold record eventually, which is 500,000 sales, over $1 million worth of income, even at wholesale level. But it grew over a period of about 10 to 12 months or so. If we'd been hit all at once, we would have had to go to a bank and ask for a loan. And I'm not sure we would have gotten one. But it built slowly enough. You know, we'd sell 100 copies here and then they might come back and order 200 copies, a given distributor. But it, we, We've been hearing about him. The guy that talked us into it was a bus driver for a local school, kids school program called Head Start, sort of a preschool bus driver. And he had some substance abuse issues that he had conquered, but he devoted his money into record collecting instead of alcohol. And that was a much more constructive use of his pay, but he became a regular every Friday. He'd show up at our warehouse and actually the basement of our house was our warehouse for the first 6 years, I guess. And bought records. He kept telling us about this guy named George Thorogood, and we never went to see him. George moved back to Delaware, where he is from, and so we kind of missed out on the opportunity, I guess. But then John booked him at a show about a mile from our house and said, listen, I'm paying to have this guy come up from Delaware to play a show, and I want you guys to come see him. So okay. So I went over, and within one song, I got on the phone to Ken and said, Ken, you got to come over here and see this guy. And he was just, we liked folk music, but one of my favorite bands was also the Rolling Stones. And George Thorogood and the Destroyers were very much like the Rolling Stones. They were kind of a blues-based rock band. Played a lot of Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry and same kind of Stones music that the early Stones had played. And so we were kind of uncertain as to whether, if we put out a band like this, whether our traditional folk music audience would abandon us and say, these guys are selling out, they're just going for rock and roll. But that didn't happen either. George, he knew a lot of the musicians we worked with. He knew Ola Bell Reed, a ballad singer from not far. She was from Maryland, he was from Delaware. He had known about her. He knew a Frank Covington that we put out a record of, a blues man from Delaware. He had a background and just a nice guy too, which made a big difference. We did evaluate when we were working with somebody, whether we thought it was somebody that had realistic expectations, somebody that we could get along with and enjoy working with. And he was all of those things. And some other people weren't, but you learn along the way. But yeah, he became a major hit. And we had all kinds of people calling us from the major labels wanting to buy his contract and so forth. He wasn't interested at the time. We weren't interested at the time. And so we put out essentially three albums before we did realize at the beginning of the MTV era, we realized we needed a music video and we had no experience and they were expensive to make. And we realized it was probably time that he moved to a major label. And so we actually formed a partnership together, a joint venture called the Rounder Destroyer Company. And we signed a deal with one of the major labels that kind of took him to another level.
Yeah, I thought
they're still out there too. Almost 50 years later, he's still touring.
Yeah, he's doing it. I lived in Philadelphia for a long time.
Oh, okay.
So yes, and he apparently used to play Dobbs and South Street and everything up there. So yes, he's well known. And I really love the story of how Newark got a baseball stadium.
Well, yeah, with the royalties, his first significant royalty check, they didn't want to just keep it for themselves. So the Destroyers helped refurbish a local field. And he's a big baseball fan at SMI. And they fixed up a ballpark in Newark, Delaware.
Yeah. No, and I am a big baseball fan too. So I, opening day would just this week, past weekend. So that made me happy to read that and see that. And you started to get big and you started to actually hire people. Can you talk a little bit about going from like three people living out of a van to a larger group of and having employees?
Yeah, it was something we weren't accustomed to, would be even the wrong word. We'd never done it before. We put it off for a long time. And one time Peter Stampfel from the group, the Holy Modal Rounders, was visiting. And he was looking at us. He said, you guys are working till midnight and then you're getting up at 6:30 in the morning. And before you have breakfast, you're putting in a couple hours packing boxes. You've got to take a break here. You'll wear yourself out. And we said, well, we can't hire people. That would be like exploitation. And he said, well, exploit me. And he said, I need a job. If I didn't live in New York, I'd be here begging you to to work for you. And he said, you'd be doing somebody a favor to hire them. There's people that need work. And so he talked us into it, and we hired a couple different people, Kathy Keat and Steve Harris, that both worked at a local record store, and both very, very good workers. And we kind of built it from there over the years. Of course, we became a much bigger company, and we set up our own distribution outfit. We ended up distributing over 400 different independent labels. We were doing a significant amount of business. We had over 100 employees near the end there, and of the distribution setup into the late 1980s and all.
And talk a little bit about what that sort of the growing pains of that too, right? Not knowing, finally hiring people, and then having large employees. They unionized and all these things that going from the 70s into the 80s and 90s and beyond, like how the record industry and business changed throughout that time.
You know, we had started hiring these first two, couple people that I mentioned. They worked out of the basement of our house. They actually both lived in the house too for a period of time. Company grew, especially with George Thorogood coming on and us taking on more labels and some of the other small labels like Alligator Records that came along just a year or two behind us. They were, you know, had built up. So they had maybe seven or eight records at the time and starting to do well with Hound Dog Taylor and some of their recordings. So we were growing. We had to hire more people. And then with George Thorogood, we ended up having to deal with a lot of radio people. We had to go out on the road with him to a lot of shows and so forth. And I think it sort of got to the point where the close family relationship that we had with the very few employees sort of fractured because we were being torn off in different directions. There were more than a few employees. And eventually some of them did form, I think we had eight or nine people at the time formed a small union, and we were taken aback. We were offended. We thought, what did we do that, you know, you would want to call the feds on us, so to speak. It was interesting. You know, it forced us to accept some of the realities that, you know, think about other people in ways that we hadn't naturally done because we were, this was a mission to us. And we were never in it with profit motive on our own. We were never in it for a weekly paycheck either. But some of the people that worked for us needed that weekly paycheck. They liked what we were doing. We had a lot of musicians that worked for us, but they didn't necessarily share our mission. They needed to get paid, and they wanted to protect themselves too. They worried that something could go wrong and we'd be off someplace and, you know, we might arbitrarily fire somebody, even though we never had, but it happens eventually. We did get somebody stealing one time, and that was, we chastised her, but we didn't actually fire her. Over time, I mean, there was one guy that actually got hired that didn't know how to read or write. It was kind of an interesting situation. You don't think to ask people when you hire them, do you know how to read or write? It's not really the kind of question that comes up. And it just was the case that he didn't. And he was hired to work in the warehouse. And, you know, we had all our records filed alphanumerically. And he, you know, within a couple of days, he was kept asking people, where is this record? And people started, you know, asking about him. And, you know, it became a situation. But it was, we went through some unbelievable things in one regard. I still have a photograph. Actually, I won't show it to you. I still have a photograph of here that somebody went to the bank and cashed a check that they had forged off of our account. And so I have the photograph that came from the bank's monitor, you know, when they caught him on camera, but, you know.
Yeah, and throughout the book, you have, there's this mixture of more photos that are professional photos, but also some photos and images that are pretty, like ones that are personally taken, right? Ones that are from like you in the van or some of the recordings you did in the house or even album lists and that kind of thing. So yeah. You've got this great mix of images for people to sort of look at and see.
Well, we were a very homegrown outfit. So we just, you know, things like that list of albums that you mentioned. I just took a, I ran it through my scanner now that I have a scanner, and it just shows where we were at a certain point in time. These were the artists that we were thinking about recording. And if you look at that list in detail, we actually did end up recording many of the people on the list.
So in 1990, you sort of move into the 90s, you turn 20, like you were saying, other labels are coming out. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the, you know, the 1990s and sort of what sort of turns you saw in, as a record label?
Things changed in a lot of ways. When we first began, there were LPs, 12-inch vinyl LPs, hence to some extent the name of the book, Vinyl Ventures. But along came cassettes, audio cassettes, as an item that you could buy and sell. I probably have one around here someplace. In 1985, compact discs came along. I know I have some of those here. But we were one of the first companies that got involved with compact disc. There was a company called Ryko Disc that was near us in the Boston area, and they jumped in with both feet, licensed a couple of albums from us to put out on CD. And then we noticed what they were doing. We went and visited the local CD manufacturer that they used, and we decided we'd start putting out our own. So we jumped in with both feet too. We put out the first bluegrass compact disc ever made, the first blues CD, first Cajun CD, different areas of folk music and all. And we really built up that area pretty big. Other things began to happen. In the late 1980s, there was the first stretch of record stores began to go out of business as some of the big chain stores like Best Buy and Circuit City came in, and they put in pretty large record departments sometimes they sold them at a loss as a way to attract customers into the store, hoping they would buy stereo equipment or something of that sort. They drove a lot of the small independent labels out of business. It became a difficult record stores, but ultimately some of the record labels also went out of business for similar reasons. They had shipped records out to all these stores that then went out of business and couldn't pay them. They sometimes over manufactured inventory because some of these stores like Circuit City, would place a large order and then end up returning many of them because they hadn't sold as well as they unknowingly thought they might. So there was a shrinkage of the industry in a sense, and that caused a bit of shaking out in a number of ways. We went through a couple of stretches where we tried to set up a national distributorship. We partnered at one time with Ryko Disc and a company in St. Louis and another company in Seattle. We put together a network that we thought could handle all the distribution for all the small labels. But that was right at the same time this shrinkage of retail hit. So that caused that one to kind of fall apart. And we formed another partnership with a California-based distributor at another time. And that one also sort of fell apart for other reasons. So there was a reason where we weren't necessarily sharing the same goals. So that partnership didn't last. But we kept working through them. And then and the next evolution came in the middle 90s or towards the later part of the 90s when digital sound became a bigger thing. And it started being that companies such as Napster came along and you could begin to download music for free. And of course that was not necessarily a good thing for a record company that was trying to sell records to people. So it really began to threaten the existence of record companies in general. Through that era, but it was not easy by any means.
And during that time, you had a couple of people let's talk about Rafi first, right? Like you had a couple of artists that you signed that became really important, right? And really instrumental. So you had Rafi that you worked with. Can you talk a little bit about that and that direction?
Yeah, we had a children's series very early on. So some of the first records we put out were children's records. Mike and Peggy Seeger doing American folk songs for children. And I went to Georgia with a friend, and we recorded an album of Bessie Jones singing children's songs. She was she'd learned her songs from her grandparents who were slaves and was passing down that kind of tradition of song and dance to current generations. But yeah, I mean, then at a certain point, we had the opportunity to work with Raffi, and to Marion and our president at the time, John Verrant, went and had a meeting with him. And he had been working with a major label in the United States, but wanted really to work more with an independent. And so we ended up doing a deal with him that still survives to this day, some 20 years later, when he does put out, he put out a record, I think, a couple years ago. He was the top children artist in the North America at the time from Canada. And so most of his records were with the Canadian label, but being the American record company was a big deal. Alison Krauss was another huge artist that we came up with early on. Ken heard a cassette of her singing with another band. She was not even named on the, she was not part of the band name, but he heard her voice and said, instantly heard that this was a very special voice. She was 13 years old when we first approached her. And needless to say, when we signed the contract, her parents had to sign on her behalf because she was a minor. By far from the only person we ever signed when they were young teenagers. Mark O'Connor was another one. Jerry Douglas was another. There were quite a number of people, even currently Sierra Hull, who we're working with right now in 2021. She was a teenager when we first recorded her. There were also plenty of people that were in their 70s and 80s when we first recorded them. But this was just another area. But Alison, of course, became a very big star, our biggest selling artist ever. Until just last month's Grammy Awards, she had won more Grammys than any female artist in history. Beyonce just topped her this most recent Grammy Awards. But Alison she's right up there. She surpassed Aretha Franklin at one point, and country, bluegrass, all kinds of Grammy Awards. She's been a wonderful person to work with over the years too. As I said, we wanted to work with people that we would enjoy working with. And of course they wouldn't want to work with us if we weren't okay to work with anyhow.
Yeah, and Alison was one of the, she was my next question, sort of, it's, yeah. and talking about that, and also, but you bring up the Grammys, and so you, and it was before Alison, though, she became really important, but you started to get some recognition beyond just your, right, some industry recognition, and starting to win Grammys, and that, so can you talk about that, too, that move from, we were just doing this to sell records out of the back of our van, literally out of the back of our van, to getting that recognition and becoming part of the industry.
Well, as I said early on, we got recognition, if you want to call it that, from music fans that said, this is great. You know, what you're doing. How about signing Riders in the Sky? We want to hear a record by them. How about signing this act and that act? Our first Grammy Award was with Gatemouth Brown, who from Louisiana. Texas and Louisiana, but recorded in Louisiana. And that was, I think, in the late 70s, middle to late 70s when we recorded him. We never thought about winning a Grammy Award. I don't know if we even knew what the Grammys were for our first few years. But it was nice to have this recognition from people that had come before us, people that worked at the Library of Congress that saw what we were doing and fed us ideas, people that worked in the industry. Record Bar was a big important chain in the Southeast at the time. And the guy that ran Record Bar kind of sent us a fan letter at one point. He said he just really enjoyed what we're doing and they liked to feature our records in their stores, which was, that felt great. Sing Out Magazine did a story on us early on, and a couple of, you know, publications did a story on Rounder, because we were kind of the first label along in what might be a sort of a second and larger wave of folk music recording. So we did get recognition from a lot of different people. And it's continued, of course, as we got to be older and more venerable and so forth, we started getting lifetime achievement awards and things of that sort. It all feels good, of course.
And as you, like, into the late 90s and into 2000s, you brought in, you mentioned John, and you sort of have a fourth rounder, right? So can you talk about, like, that transition into, you know, your 40 years?
Yeah, John Verrant was a very important ingredient in Rounder sustaining the growth that we had had. We'd hit this period of time where I mentioned it was getting more difficult to sell records, the what I call retail shrinkage and all. And he had come to us. He was a Harvard Law School student, and he'd come to us as an intern. If you can imagine somebody from Harvard Law School becoming an intern down the street, we're only about less than a mile from Harvard Law School. And he just started working as an intern for us, unpaid, and just helping out any way he could, learning the music business in a sense. He became very, very important to us. One of the things he did is, you had mentioned the union earlier on, being a lawyer and all, or a developing lawyer, he had a mindset that helped in terms of approaching things of that nature. So he handled some of our contracts for us. He joined me in terms of the negotiations with the union when it was time to renew the contract that we had with them. He became very important from the business side of things. I learned what invoice meant, and I learned some of these other things and so forth. But he had a more dispassionate sense too, because he wasn't. We were the ones that gave birth to Rounder, so to speak. He wasn't, and so when somebody from the union said something that maybe offended us, as the creator of the label, he didn't have that same defensiveness, and he was able to approach it. Things in a more rational way, I guess. Not that we flew off the top of our heads all the time, but it was just, it was great working with him. And it came a point that he had an offer to go to work for a major label in New York City. And he told us, he told me that we were going, that he was going to take this offer, but he just wanted to let us know. And actually, all three of us were in the room at the time in our conference room. And I said, John, could you go outside for a few minutes? And as soon as he left, I said to Ken and Marion, we don't want to lose him, right? And they said, of course not. And I said, let's make him the president of the company. And as a way of enticing him to stay, because Marion was the president, but she was only the president because we thought it would be nice to have a woman as president. And she was the youngest of the three of us. At one point we were had applied for a National Endowment for the Humanities grant called Youth Grants. And she was 2 years younger than us, so she was more youthful. And we got the grant. We ended up putting out 12 albums as a result of the $10,000 grant, which is a pretty good deal for the federal government. John, you know, so we did. We made him the president, and he accepted and stayed with us another 20 years or so.
And so eventually you get to the point where, you know, the music industry is changing, everything's changing, and you decide to sell to Concord Music Group. So can you talk a bit about that and that choice and sort of that move in the 2010, yeah. Right? 2010.
We were worried about this increase of digital music and the inability of us with our skill set of selling records. Making them is one thing, but selling them is another thing. It had become more important over time as we built up a significant size work, you know, people working for us, work, I can't think of the word, work staff or whatever. We were responsible for a lot of people and ourselves and our artists. We didn't know if we had what it would take to survive. We knew there would be a time that we could get past this. We were confident that there was a time that we could get past this and that some new model would present itself. But we weren't sure that we were the right people to carry the label forward. And we were in our 60s by this point, too. We weren't sure we had the whatever it took to see it through. And so we actually made a deal that was very, very worked very, very nicely and where they let us. Well, we worked together for 3 years. We did a deal in 2010, but there was a 3-year period that we had to sort of sort each other out and see. And then at 2013, we made the final deal. And then shortly afterwards, they did move the label to Nashville, which disappointed us, but we understood. Besides, it wasn't our label at that point. Anyhow, we went off the payroll. John stayed on. We produced albums on the side, and there was an agreement that they would issue the albums that we produced. And We cut back and produced a more limited number of things, but still got invited to go to different functions and all that. And it was very good. The people that started it had the right instinct. They'd come out of small label background too, and they had the right instinct for what it was like to take care of our artists and musicians. They've become a $1 billion company now. I mean, they've been a very big in terms of acquiring music catalogs, music publishing, a lot of music publishing, theatrical stuff. They own all Rodgers and Hammerstein music and so forth. I mean, it's become a major enterprise from little old Rounder putting out a couple of albums in a basement. Now we're part of this $1 billion company.
It's one of those things you never thought you'd see, and now you're here.
We're not getting the billions of dollars. We went off the payroll 8 years ago, but
and you sort of end with talking, like returning to this idea of your sense of, like, you have the sense of mission and talking about sort of travel and in your sort of ideology. So, I mean, what is it, you know, is there anything you want to talk about that sort of final, like, sort of what you, I don't know if what you learned from this is the best way to say it, but that what this experience and has meant in your life and that connection?
Well, we've gone somewhat different ways since we become less active. Ken, I think, is probably the one that's, I don't know, I feel worse for him because he was always in the studio working with musicians and he just hasn't been able to be as active at that. And then with the pandemic hitting, of course, there isn't even any live music to go see. So it's been a very, very rough stretch. I got very much into baseball, writing about baseball. And so I've put out actually dozens of books that I've written or edited about baseball and some others about music. I did a book, couple books that came through Rounder, a book about Woody Guthrie and a book about the early days of bluegrass, and put out a bluegrass music trivia book for that matter. Just kind of enjoyed my retirement by working harder than ever on just a different task. Marianne has gotten more involved with some sort of political change activities and looking at some of the issues of today.
And so usually, I mean, we've been talking for a while. My final question is, if there's anything you're working on right now that you sort of want to talk about. And so I don't know if there are any new books or anything else that you want to sort of push or talk about.
Well, in the music area, they're not really working on anything right now. As I said, I've kind of gone off the deep end in terms of working on baseball. I did hit Vinyl Ventures, I believe, was book number 101 of the books that I've written or edited. And 102 is out now, Baseball's Greatest Comeback Games. 103 is coming out next week, a book about Jackie Robinson. Many of these books I work on with multiple authors. Both of those books have 30 or 40 authors. And I've kind of write an opening essay in one of the articles, but then I gather the works of all these other people that write on special topics and edit them together as a book. And it's really kept me very busy. I've got an article that I wrote coming out in the International Country Music Journal in a couple of months on the history of a local band in the Boston area called Joe Val and the New England Bluegrass Boys. I'd written up a history for them. And so that'll be nice to see that come out in June, as I expect. I like writing history, I guess, and researching some of the past. And it's all popular culture, be it baseball or music.
Yes, and now that there's the return of, like, you can actually go and watch baseball finally.
I did.
So we'll see what happens. I'm a big Cubs fan, so.
Well, the Cubs, like the Red Sox, finally won the World Series again.
Oh, I know. Yeah, so usually my life starts out really exciting in, like, April, and then we get, in 2016 we got to October and we're excited. And I guess we'll wait 100 years again and see what happens. It'll be okay. But Bill, it's been great talking to you again. This was Bill Nowlin, who is the author of Vinyl Ventures, My 50 Years at Rounder Records. Bill, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you, Rebecca. I enjoyed it very much.